The Guardian.
Before, you would only need to go out like a few metres from where we would normally go out to start catching our fish. These days the fish has migrated, so you have to go further away and you need to like use a motorised boat to get to where the fish is.
For me it takes much longer now because it's a lot of changes, even like the weather, for example. Like that time when it was 800 kilos, it just went like that, you know. But now, it takes longer.
And all depends also when you go to sea, what month you go to sea, like December, January, February. That time, we could still go catch our fish. But now come December, January, February, most of the crayfish die. And what the market is also doing now, they mainly exporting frozen crayfish and frozen tails. Where before 2003, 2004, most of your crayfish were export live.
Those are the voices of fisherwomen from the Western Cape in South Africa. They say fishing conditions are changing. They say the sea is warming and the storms are coming in faster and harder. But is it climate change or something else? Well, later this month, further around the South African coast in Durban, world leaders will descend for yet another round of climate change talks. But what will be achieved? Expectations were high in 2009 in Copenhagen, and then last year in Cancun, that a comprehensive deal to cap harmful global emissions would be struck. But these hopes were dashed. Now the date for a conclusion of a deal seems to get further and further away. So will a deal really be struck this year? I'm John Vidal, and this is The Guardian's Global Development Podcast. And this month we're asking what COP17 will mean for global development. Joining me are Salim Al-Haq, Senior Climate Change Fellow at the International Institute for Environment and Development, who's on the line from Durban. Hello, Salim.
Hello.
Hi. Alison Doig, Senior Policy Advisor on Climate Change from Christian Aid. She's here in the studio.
Hello.
Chandu Krishnan, the Executive Director of Transparency International, who's also in the studio.
Hello.
And a local man, Desmond Desar from the South Durban Community Environment Alliance, who's going to give us some idea of what's really happening in Durban. Desmond, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Good to hear you. So, Salim, stories from fisherwomen there about how things are changing. Tell us what you're hearing from Bangladesh and other Asian countries. Are you hearing many stories of changing climate?
Yes, indeed, John. Everywhere I go, you hear this everywhere. People are saying that they are seeing anomalies in the climate that they have never seen before in the last many, many decades. It looks like this is very much attributable to the global warming that we've already seen, which is about 0.7 degrees centigrade temperature rise over the last century. I was just recently in Bangkok during the massive floods that they've had, totally unprecedented floods in Thailand of that scale. There have been similar floods in Pakistan and in Vietnam. And everywhere you go, you see these anomalous weather conditions.
Alison, from Christian Aid, you have partners with groups all the way around the world. Are you hearing the same thing as well?
No, absolutely. What they say is how they experience climate change in their own life is how they experience water, and it's often too much water in terms of flooding. I mean, Bangladesh is a case in point. Too little water, the droughts that we have seen in East Africa, it's difficult to attribute exactly what level of climate change has played in that, but there's definitely a strong feeling that climate change is playing a part in the intensity of these events. The wrong type of water, we heard from the fisherwoman, again in Bangladesh, is salination of water that's used for agriculture, and the wrong timing of water, that farmers don't know when the rains are going to come and when they're going to end and how much they are. So our partners are constantly telling us that they're experiencing this changes in their climate.
Desmond, in Durban, you're a city man. What's going on in the cities? Are they becoming warmer? Is it hotter? Are conditions better or worse now? What's going on?
The weather pattern is inconsistent. It's intermittent rain. You wake up in the morning, you know, you go out and it's cold and you're in your jersey, you're in your pullovers and your warm woolies. And then you find just about an hour or two after that, it starts, the wind starts picking up, it starts getting darker, and it starts getting cold. And then all of a sudden you get a rain or, you know, those sort of patterns are not the Durban weather at all. You know, we used to have, especially this part of the year, it's very warm in Durban.
What does seem to be abundantly clear is that there is growing frustration and even anger at the lack of progress in these talks. Earlier this week, I spoke to former Costa Rican President José María Figueres. Now, he's calling for an Occupy-style movement by developing countries at the talk.
We went to Copenhagen, COP15, with the great illusion that knowing what we do about climate change, we would be able to reach an agreement that was equitable between developed and developing nations, that would have contributed to create a win-win condition for all in terms of shifting our development towards a low-carbon economy. We did not reach an agreement at Copenhagen. We then went to Cancun, and now we're going to Durban, and I already hear talk of the fact that we will need yet more conferences after Durban. At some point in time, we need to get serious. And that is why I have come out with the notion of Occupy Durban. I am talking about Occupy Durban in the sense that we should be going there with the firm conviction that we will go to Durban and we will not come back as country delegations unless we have clearly defined what the financial mechanism will be to help for adaptation, unless we know where the funds are going to be coming out from.
Salimu, this sounds very dramatic, Occupy Durban. Is it a right tactic? What are you hearing in the corridors as people prepare for the talks?
Well, I actually have a lot of sympathy for that, and because negotiations and participating in talks endlessly is just getting us nowhere. In fact, just a few days ago in Bangladesh, Dhaka, there was a meeting of a vulnerable countries group. Nearly 30 countries from Asia, Africa, Latin America got together under the leadership of Prime Minister Hasina of Bangladesh. This is a group that was set up by President Nasheed of the Maldives 2 years ago, just before Copenhagen, and it's grown. And in fact, former President Figueres of Costa Rica was there, and he made this appeal to the leaders at that meeting in Dhaka as well. And I fully support it. What I've been trying to tell these leaders from the vulnerable countries is that they should come to Durban, and then instead of going into the meeting at the beginning in the conference hall, just stand out.
Salim, are you saying that people really should just boycott these talks? I mean, are you looking for a big statement from developing countries that some action has to be taken? I mean, how far would you go? I mean, would you advise...
Well, the statements have been coming thick and fast. Nobody's listening to them. So they have to do more than just simply come to the talks and make a statement.
Alison, how do developing countries increase their influence? I mean, are they up against a brick wall here?
Very interesting question, because developing countries are increasingly being pressurized into making more and more of their own commitments. In fact, in committing in many ways to doing more than the rich countries are. Chris Yoon was saying, yes, we'll join KP, but we need all the big middle-income countries, our up-and-coming countries, to make their commitments also. But that's in the context when you've got the USA, Japan, Canada saying they're not going to have a binding agreement. They want it to be voluntary. So how can you put pressure and sort of bully the developing countries when, on the other hand, you're allowing the rich countries away? And there's evidence to show that the commitments made by developing countries are already to cut more carbon than is being committed by the rich countries. So I think they're absolutely right and just to make a stand.
Desmond, what's the view from the street? I mean, do you think direct action like this from ambassadors and delegations is necessary? Or what can you, from outside the talks, you know, you're the voiceless, if you like, what can you say from outside?
Well, we expect little from the governments gathered for this Durban COP. They have not shown themselves to be serious about addressing climate change. They have not shown themselves capable of leading the necessary change in the economic system of production and consumption. So we expect little from them. What we expect, much from the people. You know, on the streets of Copenhagen and Cancun, people chant to change the system, not the climate. This is a real issue. This is what will be debated in the People's Autonomous Space in Durban at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. This is what people from South Durban, together with allies from all around the city and the world, will call for as we join together on the global day of action on the 3rd of December.
Thank you. Here's a question from our talk point on the Guardian Global Development website. A chap called Richard Kimboa, and he writes, what are the stumbling blocks to financing adaptation to climate change in developing and vulnerable countries? How far can Durban deliver the needed finance in the light of these limitations? Here in the studio with me is Transparency International's UK director, Chandu Krishnan. Chandu, Richard was referring there to the Green Climate Fund. This was proposed at the Cancun Climate Change last week. Progress seems to have been fantastically slow. It's coming back onto the agenda. You've just released a report about the dangers of this money being pledged to help communities because you think it may get corrupted. What are your concerns?
Well, firstly, I should explain that while we do have concerns that weak governance and high levels of corruption could result in monies not going to the persons they intended to reach, it's very important that that should not be used as an excuse to halt progress towards agreement on the funds, nor should it be used as an excuse to welch on commitments that have been made. To provide the necessary level of funding. That level of funding is critical, precisely to help the vulnerable communities whom we've heard in very graphic terms describe how climate change is impacting on them. The solution, in our view, is to try and understand how corruption risks could be a problem and to put in place measures and mechanisms to reduce those risks. And we do believe it can be done. The starting point, of course, is to have full transparency and accountability in the way...
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
When I say donors who contribute resources need to be fully transparent about what financing they're providing and through what means. The counterpart to that is that recipients should be equally transparent in accounting for the use of funds. And we also believe that it may be necessary in some countries where capacity is weak to strengthen the whole process of public financial management so that there is greater oversight, for instance, by Parliament over how monies are spent. We think that civil society can be strengthened in many countries to serve as a mechanism to monitor how, say, funds for adaptation are used.
So, Salim, this makes perfect sense, but can you tell us what is at stake here? I mean, the Green Climate Fund is, how much money is possibly going to be put up, and how much difference will it make possibly to developing countries?
Well, there are two pots of money that are being discussed. The Green Climate Fund is $100 billion a year starting in 2020, which will cover adaptation, mitigation, and a host of other activities. There's also a short-term, what is called the fast-track funding of $30 billion over 3 years, which is beginning to flow, but is flowing in various different channels, and that's the discussion going on here in Durban, or will go on next week, on exactly how those will flow to which countries and by what means. But the point is quite well taken, is that these need to be done in a transparent manner. The problem is we really don't know where the money is going, what it's being spent on, who's getting it. But on the other hand, a lot of developing countries are actually going ahead and doing things on the ground, even with very little resources flowing to them. I'll give you one example from Bangladesh. They have set up a national climate change trust fund in which, over the last 3 years, the government of Bangladesh has put in $100 million a year, every year for 3 years. So $300 million of their own money into developing and implementing a national climate change strategy and action plan.
Chandu, I mean, we're reading a lot about the forests and the red. This is the reforestation money, which could be, you know, tens of billions of dollars a year. But we're also finding that in places like Peru and Congo and wherever, you have what you call the carbon cowboys moving in and signing up vast swathes of forest and basically trying to appropriate all the potential money. Are you really worried that this money could actually just get nowhere near the intended recipients, the people actually on the ground who are meant to be there looking after the forests?
Yes, we are concerned because there have already been reports that in some countries the so-called carbon cowboys have been secretly negotiating deals with governments who have not acted transparently and are making these deals without consulting local communities, forest-dependent communities, communities who actually own the forest. And so the danger is that these communities will be completely cut off from this whole process. Apart from, of course, the danger that if those who are seeking to make these deals cannot be trusted, then one wonders also as to whether the carbon emission reductions which are supposed to result from these arrangements would actually take place. It's also the case, unfortunately, that many countries that have rich forest cover also tend to have high levels of corruption. That corruption is manifest also in ministries dealing with forests and in forest departments. But again, it is possible to understand those risks and find mechanisms which can reduce that corruption risk.
It's a frightening prospect, and huge work needs to be done there. Now, Alison, I'm going to come to you because the second big, really big question about this whole conference, I think, will be on the future of the Kyoto Protocol. This is the agreement by which rich countries commit to cutting emissions. But it seems that Russia and America and various others don't want this, and that the whole Kyoto Protocol is now in danger. Is this going to be a major problem at the talks, do you think?
I wouldn't say that the Kyoto Protocol is dead, and I think the one opportunity we have to see a future for it, and we must remember that Kyoto is our only legally binding agreement for cutting carbon globally. We may want to project forward to 2015, 2020 to have every country in a deal that's moving towards cutting carbon. At the moment, our only binding deal is Kyoto. And the European Union has said that they will sign up to the next commitment period of Kyoto on condition. And the conditions are very largely around middle-income countries taking their commitment as soon as possible.
Salima, what are you hearing from Durban itself? Kyoto surely is going to be a major issue. The Africa group have already said that they're not going to let it go. The LDCs similarly. What about Bangladesh? I mean, is this a sort of totemic position which you must take, or is there room? Is there wriggle room for a compromise here?
Well, the developing countries, particularly the vulnerable developing countries like the least developed countries and the Africa group who just met yesterday, and have a very strong position that they want the Kyoto Protocol second commitment period to come on board. They want the non-Kyoto parties like the US and China and India to also come on board to a legally binding agreement at the same time. But they recognize that the politics of the global situation right now, with domestic politics in the US the way it is, and the situation in the rich countries going through a recession, makes that very, very difficult. So perhaps a compromise formula of keeping the Kyoto Protocol going while the other countries negotiate a legally binding agreement in the next few years, not in Durban, but they agree to it in a few years' time, while the Kyoto parties agree to a second commitment period for a few years, might be the compromise that would come out of Durban as something that everybody could sign on to.
Well, everyone seems to want a compromise, and earlier this week we had UK Energy and Climate Secretary Chris Huhne telling us what he thought the UK wanted from the talks, and this is what he was prepared to say, and I quote, "A global deal covering all major economies is not a luxury. It is not an optional extra. It is an absolute necessity. Yes, a global deal may be out of reach today, but we can and we must provide a clear signal that this is our objective. Time is running short. We are walking down a dangerous path." Alison, does that fill you with confidence?
The question I'd ask in the result of that is who does take the lead? Who actually moves us into that, and it should it be China and India? And ultimately, yes, they should be part of a binding deal, but should they lead the way, or should it be the wealthy countries? And that's where we believe that the European Union can take the lead to bring other wealthy countries along with them. And I think the other question you have to ask is, if we don't have Kyoto Protocol, if we don't have a binding deal going forward, the alternative on our offer is a voluntary scheme, a pledge and review. Countries decide how much they're going to do. And if you total up what they've pledged already, we're not going to stay. We've already been told we're going to awards a 3.5 degree warming at least. If we move towards a pledge and a review voluntary approach, the future is much more bleak than that.
Desmond, you hear Chris Huhne and these great politicians, and they come to you and they make all these promises, and they're full of rhetoric and fine words. Do they fill you with any hope, or have you actually given up on them now and think it's really every country for itself now?
Yeah, what we see on the ground with people affected with climate change already in Durban and in the province I come from, And so people do not believe that the politicians can deliver. It needs to be a collective voice. There needs to be a new system that will change it completely. And so communities are coming together in Durban to advocate for a long-term environmental justice movement that will really put pressure on the government of the world so that we can get about a just and change in this, completely. And we can't wait anymore. The time is right now.
So, what about the solutions? It seems that many developing countries are just not waiting for an agreement, but already investing heavily in renewable energies. In South Africa, which is a great big coal producer, they're starting to develop wind. Now, here is Neil Townsend. He's the director of a small company called Good Energy, which is trying to build 4 wind farms. The difference is that all the money would go to communities, and just 9 wind turbines on one site, he reckons, can provide $30 to $50 million over 20 years. Think of what that would do for a township of 20,000 people. It's extraordinary. Here he is.
The interesting thing about renewable energy is that it has created a really interesting opportunity for a lot of communities. I mean, if we look around, particularly here in South Africa, we come across a lot of communities that actually have a really, potentially a very good land base in terms of renewable energy. They might be in a place where there's loads of solar energy or a place like this where it's really windy. Those guys might have that farm and that resource is there on the farm. And if they can tap into that resource, then there's something there they can potentially sell that energy, and then that energy can create revenues going back into the community.
So, are you seeing this in Asia and Bangladesh? Is renewable energy now a genuine option for developing countries, or is the technology out of reach and not really still coming at all?
No, I think renewable energies and clean technologies generally are reaching the cusp where they are now becoming quite viable opportunities for many developing countries. I'll give you 2 examples. The country of Maldives is going to make itself carbon neutral by 2020, despite the fact that it's heavily dependent on imported diesel fuel. There have been a massive program of putting in clean energy across the different islands, and particularly the resorts that they have there. In Bangladesh has, in the last few years, had over 1 million households put in solar energy on their poor households, on their roofs. This is commercially driven by companies that are making profits by selling these items to relatively poor households all over the country.
Desmond, coal is very cheap in South Africa. There's hardly any renewables there. Do you really mind where the electricity comes from as long as you get it? I mean, half of South Africa still gets no electricity, whatever.
We certainly believe, and even the community that live alongside the Kusila and Medupi coal-fired power stations. Whose energy? The question is that whose energy for who? Who's this extra energy for? Is it for local people? Is it for people that live alongside these facilities who suffer the health impacts? Certainly not. So whilst on the one hand we're saying it's cheap electricity for who? For the big aluminium smelters in South Africa who only employ 1,500 people? And get it at 7 times less than the ordinary citizen in South Africa. Who pays the price for all these loans?
Alison, can I bring you in here? I mean, it's not development at any cost, is it?
No, but we've got an opportunity here, I think, just to follow on what we heard from Desmond there. Christian Aid have just released their Low Carbon Africa report, and that's saying on the one hand, there's this desperate need for energy in Africa. For, you know, 70% of people in sub-Saharan Africa don't have electricity, can't put on a light switch. 80% cook on an open fire, on a bonfire, every day, every meal. There's a desperate need. On the other hand, these countries want to develop and become middle-income countries and bigger economic players. So the needs are huge. And we're seeing in our report, in the Low Carbon Africa report, that they have 2 choices. They can go the brown route, the dirty route, tie into fossil fuels now, or they can go the low carbon route, the decentralised energy, taking energy where it is, using the resources, as we heard in that clip there, resources are abundant and local. So we have an opportunity to put some of the mitigation funds. Africa has had a pittance in terms of mitigation carbon cutting money. So we're asking for a fair share for Africa. So we have a choice here. And there's a real opportunity and a positive opportunity we can take and say, yes, African countries can develop in a low carbon way.
So is there going to be a deal? Let's end on the thoughts of a Kenyan who's on the climate caravan in a bunch of buses travelling down to the talks in Durban. She represents vulnerable pastoralist communities in Kenya.
People from Durban, or at least the COP17 meeting, will actually come up with resolutions that are going to directly address pastoral people and specifically gender in as far as climate change debate is concerned, so that we have actions that are oriented or directed specifically towards women especially, because you find that they're the ones who are greatly affected. They're the keepers of society, as we say in my country, and they're the ones who have to go looking for firewood, and firewood is disappearing as the forests disappear. They disappear, they have to walk for longer distances to get water because water is no longer available. Groundwater has become too saline for them to actually use. I would hope to see from Durban something that can actually address gender issues.
So Salim, this is the billion-dollar question. What are your hopes and fears for Durban?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have very high hopes. This is the 17th time that these countries have got together and still haven't got their act together. But I have greater hope, actually, from what I see happening on the ground. In fact, people, countries, nations, and actors at various levels, from cities to corporations to private citizens, are not sitting idle. They're going ahead and tackling the actual problems of dealing with climate change, as we've heard a number of examples of. And I think that really is where the hope lies. So it's no longer dependent on getting these global agreements, important as they are.
Chandish Krishnan from Transparency International, what do you think? What are your hopes for the conference?
I must say that if one looks at the history of UN intergovernmental negotiations, progress is very slow. It's always incremental. But, you know, the negotiators in Durban, they represent the present generation. The future generations, of course, are not present at the negotiating table. But these people can't let down future generations. And I think the way to do that is to agree on binding commitments, both in terms of reduction of emission, greenhouse gas emissions, and at the same time to address the corruption risk.
Mm-hmm. And Alison, hopes and fears?
I'd say my hope would be that the civil society, its voice is heard, that this caravan of hope that's going down to Durban, right across Africa and down to Durban, makes an impact and is heard, and that there is some progress towards a long-term binding deal. My expectations, unfortunately, are that there will be further delays and procrastination on the negotiators' part, and it will again be put off till next year.
And Desmond, the man from Durban, tell us what your hopes and fears are, please.
We are worried about what Durban's going to deliver. We think it's going to either be a conference of the polluters, or will it be a conference of the people? We think there's going to be no deal. It's going to fail, like it's failed for the 17 years. People are going to just come to Durban and have a talk.
Well, on that rather depressing note, I'm afraid we have to say that's all from the Guardian Development podcast for this week, ahead of the talks in Durban, South Africa. My great thanks to Salim Ul-Haq, Alison Doig, Desmond Desar and Chandra Krishnan. I'm John Vidal. If you want to continue the debate, check out Guardian Global Development website. That's www.guardian.co.uk/global-development. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.